Welcome to Antioch. We are a multi-generational, justice-minded church in beautiful Bend, Oregon, seeking and celebrating the reconciliation of all things. May the Word of God turn your heart toward Christ and the world He loves.
As we move from gathering to listening, our scripture reading today is from the book of Exodus, chapter 20, verses 1 through 17. And God spoke all these words, "I am the Lord your God who brought you out of Egypt, out of the land of slavery. You shall have no other gods before me. You shall not make for yourself an image in the form of anything in heaven above, or on the earth beneath, or in the waters below. You shall not bow down to them or worship them, for I, the Lord your God, am a jealous God, punishing the children of the sin of the parents to the third and the fourth generation of those who hate me, but showing love to 1,000 generations of those who love me and keep my commandments. You shall not misuse the name of the Lord your God, for the Lord will not hold anyone guiltless who misuses his name. Remember the Sabbath day by keeping it holy. 6 days you shall labor and do all your work, but the seventh day is a Sabbath to the Lord your God. On it you shall not do any work, neither you nor your son or daughter, nor your male or female servant, nor your animals, nor any foreigner residing in your towns. For in 6 days the Lord made the heavens and the earth, the sea, and all that is in them, but he rested on the seventh day. Therefore the Lord blessed the Sabbath day and made it holy. Honor your father and mother, so that you may live long in the land the Lord your God is giving you. You shall not murder. You shall not commit adultery. You shall not steal. You shall not give false testimony against your neighbor. You shall not covet your neighbor's house. You shall not covet your neighbor's wife, or his male or female servant, or his ox or donkey, or anything that belongs to your neighbor. This is the word of the Lord. Thanks be to
God. Morning, church. Well, my name is Sean. I'm one of the pastors on the team, and today we are continuing right along in our Exodus journey. We've come pretty far, and we have a few more weeks left before we wrap up this story. As you heard from Natalie, we'll be discussing the Ten Commandments this morning. And part of what's interesting to me about the Ten Commandments is there's something that we are generally familiar with. Like we know what they are. They seem to pop up in the news every year or so as well. As many of you may have heard, a law was passed in Louisiana just last month requiring that the Ten Commandments be on display in all public classrooms. It's not the first time we've heard of laws like this or a state doing this. We've seen it in relation to courtrooms or other civic buildings. And I was about a decade or so ago now, and I'm sure there have been other attempts since then, but there was a bill up in the House of Representatives that would have required the Ten Commandments to be on display in both chambers of Congress. And famously or infamously, one of the co-sponsors of that bill was interviewed by Stephen Colbert. And he sought to understand why this representative was so passionate about displaying the Ten Commandments there. And so he asked him, "Well, why don't you just tell me what the Ten Commandments are?" How many do you think he got? He could get to 3. That was it. And, you know, we can laugh at that or shrug or sigh or cry at that. But I think if we're all honest with ourselves, the list can actually be kind of hard to name. We know the ones like don't kill, steal, or lie. But after that, there's like a couple ones on coveting and not really sure what order they go in. And what makes it even more complicated is there are actually 3 different versions. They all contain the same principles, but they're broken down differently depending upon one's tradition. There's a Jewish version, there's a Catholic and Orthodox version, and then there is a Protestant version. So for people who might want them on display in public places, we aren't even sure which one of those to use. And they first appear here, but they also show back up slightly different in Deuteronomy as well. So it's kind of confusing. And the challenge is when we talk about putting the Ten Commandments on display in public places, they wrench the Ten Commandments out of their narrative and covenantal context. So let's talk about that context to start, because it is often missing from any larger discussion about the Ten Commandments. And this may be really silly to point out, but we are in the 20th chapter of Exodus and not the first chapter, okay? That's why you come to me for the important insights here. But God does not start Exodus 1 or Genesis 1 with the Ten Commandments. In just the last 7 weeks, we have heard a lot of this story, but in the first 19 chapters of the Exodus narrative, God has seen the people suffering. He has shared his divine name with Moses. He has shown his true power in contrast to Pharaoh. He has brought them out of slavery across the sea and into freedom. He has provided food and water in the wilderness. And so when we do finally arrive, we're at our text today in Exodus 20, the words that God speaks, we must understand that God and his people have already been in relationship for generations. This isn't where it starts. God has displayed a passionate love for his people and shown that love through liberating them from bondage and feeding them with the bread of heaven. In Exodus 19, right before our text, God actually sets up the context for Moses just in case he forgot as well. God points back to the Exodus and he basically says, "You have seen what I have already done for you in the past." Then he points forward to the identity and the role that God's people will have among the nations, basically showing the Israelites what you will be in the future. And on the basis of that historical fact of what I've already done for you and that missional future I have in store for you, it is in that context that God gives them the Ten Commandments. And what we'll see is the Ten Commandments come in the form of two tables. The first table, which refers to the first four commandments, is generally how to live before or with God. And then table two, starting at 5 and finishing out, is generally about how we live with each other. Of course, there's overlap there. And whether it is in the first or the second table, what we see is that the Ten Commandments almost serve as like a trust exercise about the nature of reality. Will God's people trust that God's ways are truly best? I mean, what harm does a little coveting do, right? It's never hurt anybody before. It's not so bad. I think that may be what the whole advertising industry is built on. What real damage does catching up at the office on the Sabbath do anyways? That's a victimless crime, right? Productivity is good. What if I stretch the truth about how long I was at work or how many donuts I ate or, you know, whatever it is, right? Is that really so bad? Who am I hurting when I do that? But what we see God saying is, do you trust me that those other ways of life are not good for you? I'm telling you that this is the way to order your life. This is the way to live your life. And our perception of the Ten Commandments is as this, you know, rigid set of rules and of laws that we must follow. It's a, you know, a divine finger wagging or a moral slap on the hand. But is that really what they are? Walter Brueggemann says this. He says, these commands might be taken not as a series of rules, but as a proclamation in God's own mouth of who God is and how God shall be practiced by this community of liberated slaves. So let's see how that's true. The text begins like this. And God spoke all these words, I am the Lord your God, who brought you out of Egypt, out of the land of slavery. So we refer to these as the Ten Commandments, but in the Jewish tradition, they refer to them as the Decalogue or the Ten Words. And these words given by God begin with him reminding his people about the Exodus, that context we talked about, in case they have forgotten. He says, I am the God who took you from slavery to freedom. And so the words that God offers are based on who God is, what God has already done. And these words he offers are because he is already in a covenant with these people. These commandments are given to an already elected, redeemed, believing, and worshiping community. This opening sentence, which actually serves as the first commandment in the Jewish tradition, is so often left out of the lists of the Ten Commandments that we want to put on public displays. We skip right over this, but this opening word from God emphasizes that these words are personally oriented. He says, I am the Lord, your God, who brought you out of Egypt. The commandments are only given to them in relationship. That God's saving actions have drawn God's people into this new life, which they are experiencing already, and the people are to respond by living their lives in a certain way because of what God has already done. So just a few more notes before we dive into the specific commandments themselves. First, you'll notice that these commandments have to do with the shape of life, again, for those already in relationship with God, and yet they do not contain specific judicial consequences for disobedience. The commandments being obligatory is not conditional on them being enforceable. It's not about God threatening them about what will happen. It's about them being obligatory because of who God is. This is, I think, kind of like the original gentle parenting. They're not threatening them about what's going to happen. It's out of the covenantal relationship that they have with God who created and redeemed them. Second, sometimes you'll hear that the Ten Commandments were about the law, but the gospel is about grace, or the New Testament is about grace. And I think that is a false dichotomy. God does not give the Ten Commandments as a means for salvation or even as a way to establish a relationship with the people. God establishes the relationship first and then gives the law. And then finally, while I did just say the commandments are personal, they aren't actually about you or me in the individual sense. God gives these commandments not so you or I can be better or live our best lives now, but so our neighbors can have their best life now. These commandments should point us vertically towards God and horizontally towards our community. So, first table is about that vertical relationship with God. These first four commandments point us toward God and show us that the goal of life is a faith attuned to God's ways. And in order to do that, we have to turn away from the things that we might seek instead of seeking God himself. So the first commandment says, you shall have no other gods before me. And the second says, you shall not make yourself an image in the form of anything in heaven above or the earth beneath or in the waters below. Goes on a little bit more, but these first two commandments deal with the idea that God's people are to rely on God alone for their needs. That God knew back then, as he knows now, that we can find plenty of other things, people, places to put our trust in, to seek after, and even to worship. And it can be easy for us, separated from these Ten Commandments, to take them extremely literally, to think of other religions, or maybe strictly of golden calves, which is actually what we're going to learn about next week. But I think it's so much more than that. Whether it is those other gods in that first commandment or idols in the second, the list is long of things that rival God for our attention and our devotion. Money, sex, power, fame, productivity, our devices, that one hurts, social media, your image, you name it. These are things that vie for our devotion and our attention. And the covenant that God established with his people means he expects exclusive loyalty in return. So commandment three, you shall not misuse the name of the Lord your God, for the Lord will not hold anyone guiltless who misuses his name. Now, I don't know about you, but the way that I was taught this one growing up was to not use the Lord's name in vain. And there were two main ways in which you could use the Lord's name in vain. The first one was saying, oh my gosh, but not gosh, you know, right? And the second one was saying, gosh darn it, but not gosh or darn it, right? Those were like the two ways you broke this commandment, was doing those things. I think when we examine it more closely, it's about misusing God's name for your own purposes. And God's name in the Exodus story is actually a really big deal. If you remember back to when we talked about Moses and the burning bush, that was God revealing his name to him for the first time, right? The great I am, we sang that earlier. That God was putting his trust in Moses by revealing his name to him and by extension, the people of God. So throughout the book of Genesis, God was identified not by name, but through his relationship with the patriarchs as the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and Jacob. Jacob was even refused the knowledge of God's name. Hagar gave God a name, but it wasn't the name that God revealed himself. Because knowing another's name allows for a certain amount of power. And now that they knew it, Moses and the Israelites could act in God's name for better or for worse. They could honor God's name. They could kind of misrepresent it, or as we see here, as God talks about, they could misuse God's name. And what I think God is saying here is don't do things in my name that aren't actually from me. Don't put my seal of approval on something when I haven't given it. And when I think back to my high school self, I definitely did this. Has anybody else broken up with someone and blamed it on God? Right? Anybody done that, right? Yeah, thank you, Nuka. You're with me. You know, I wish we could stay together, but God says we can't. So I'll see you in gym class tomorrow, right? So obviously that sounds silly, and we want to listen to the Lord in our relationships, all that. But we can think of more extreme examples than that, right? Right? Starting a war in God's name. God said that we need to do this. Or in this election season about God's chosen candidate. And with this theme of trust, part of the reason why this is important is because it hurts God's witness to the world. If people associate God's name with negative things, things that God did not sanction, it reflects poorly back on God. So it's not about, you know, not saying, oh my gosh, but it's about not hindering God's mission of reconciling all people back to him. Commandment 4, remember the Sabbath day by keeping it holy. 6 days you shall labor and do all your work, but the seventh day is a sabbatical, or a Sabbath to the Lord your God. On it you shall not do any work, neither you, nor your son or daughter, nor your male or female servant, nor your animals, nor any foreigner residing in your towns. For in 6 days the Lord made the heavens and the earth, the sea and all that is in them, but he rested on the seventh day. Therefore the Lord blessed the Sabbath day and made it holy. So when we think about the Ten Commandments, it may be more accurate for us to call them the Nine Commandments and One Suggestion, right? Those other ones are important. We got to do those other Nine Commandments, but the Sabbath, that's a really nice idea, isn't it? It's kind of cute. Just take a day off, right? And if we're honest with ourselves, we don't put it on the same level as the other Nine Commandments. Why is that? Is it because we tend to have a proclivity to assign worth to things that are productive, that get things done, that accomplish things, that produce results? That's clearly not the intent of the Sabbath. As far as the available evidence shows, the Sabbath was a unique Israelite institution, unknown in any of the surrounding cultures of the ancient world. But its inclusion here is a reminder that all of creation is a gift, and we have a responsibility to be wise stewards of it. That we were created to live and work in the earth in relationship with God who created it and us. Work is a good thing and part of our mission with this good creation that we are part of. However, when it gets alienated from God, we can easily put our significance in our work and give it an outsized position in our life. It can become an idol. We just learned that those are bad if we don't put proper limits on it. It can define our very being and become our identity, right? The first thing we share with people we just met, it's often what we do for work, right? And what's especially interesting here on the Sabbath is that the rationale for its inclusion is different here when the Ten Commandments are first given than when this story is repeated in Deuteronomy 5. Here, the reason for the Sabbath is so that God's people can mimic God's resting during his originating creation. In Deuteronomy, the reason for the Sabbath is Israel's previous experience as slaves before their deliverance by God. The idea being that the Israelites desperately needed rest, but did not get it while they were slaves, and only received it when God saved them. Because of this, they were to empathize with those who are not free or those who are overworked, and to pass on that rest as it directly ties to God's saving act and who God is. So the rationale for the Sabbath in Exodus is about mimicking God's rest in creation. Here we see that it should mimic the progression from slavery to salvation, and offer that to others. Essentially, this is the first fair labor law. Sabbath wasn't just for the head of the household, but also for the working poor, for children, for servants, even the animals. As this idea of Sabbath would grow and expand, it would be about trusting God with our time and our productivity and become more than just about one day a week, but a way of life. And Sabbath serves as the transition point in the Ten Commandments, because it is about both our vertical relationship with God, but also our horizontal relationship with our neighbors and the rest of creation. So as we get into the second table, this idea, again, is not about self-improvement, but neighbor improvement. Fifth commandment, honor your father and your mother so that you may live long in the land that your Lord, that the Lord your God is giving you. This is one you may have talked about a lot in Sunday school growing up, how you need to listen to your parents, which is a true and a good thing. But this commandment is not addressed to children, but to adults. It is a reminder that you are not self-made and that you stand on the shoulders of others, particularly your parents. And what's unique about this commandment is that it elevates the status of women, honoring them just as important as honoring men, as mothers and fathers, and it's the only commandment which is attached to promise. It seems that God knew that the future of their community and their society would rest in caring for the passing of generations. And while aging generations may not have been as useful to the economy as they once were, they are essential to family. And failing to honor one's parents implies and imperils the fundamental structure of the society. So for those of you with aging parents, and you feel like you may be at the end of your rope, you are doing good and holy work. Work God has called you to do, work that God will sustain you for. So let's do 6, 7, and 8 together. You shall not murder. You shall not commit adultery. You shall not steal. So these are some of the shorter verses in the Bible. Ones I don't really need to add too much on. Don't do them. Again, these second table commandments are all about relating to our neighbors, establishing trust in the family, establishing trust in the community, and each of these things breaks those bonds. We saw in Genesis that others are gifts who bear the image of God, and their lives deserve to be protected and preserved at all costs. Killing them or taking from them is unacceptable because they are image bearers. And when it comes to adultery, this one comes in between murder and theft, and I think it's because it has something to do with both. Adultery kills a marriage and steals someone that belongs to someone else. If the commandments are to draw us towards improving the lives of our neighbors, this does the opposite of that. It breaks family bonds, it sows distrust, and it has far-reaching consequences beyond the bedroom. Ninth commandment, you shall not give false testimony against your neighbor. Lying about one's neighbor is the opposite of building up the community. It tears it down. This originally referred to kind of court or official disputes, but it also embodies a concern about truthfulness in all spheres of human relationships. If these commandments are to help protect our witness to God, being known as someone who is untruthful or as someone who bends the truth hurts that witness, hurts the witness of God's love in the world. And last, but certainly not least, the 10th commandment. You shall not covet your neighbor's house. You shall not covet your neighbor's wife or his male or female servant, his ox or donkey, or anything that belongs to your neighbor. We see that the list ends where sin begins. While the preceding commandments have highlighted specifics, the 10th commandment goes to the source of what the other commandments have prohibited, which is covetous desire. It makes clear that covenant loyalty in Israel went far deeper than just external conformity to laws. That the God who claimed his people's love and also claimed the rest of their affections and their desires. And what is coveting other than wrongly directed love? Putting things or people in the place that only God should be. In this way, the commandments, they come full circle because to break the 10th is to break the first. To covet is to perform idolatry. And we'll talk in a moment more about Jesus, but he would pick up on this idea. He would continue to expand this idea just as this 10th commandment expands on the 9 before Jesus would do it. That it is more than what you do, it is even how you do it or how you think about it that matters. Jesus would say, "You have heard it said, but I tell you," right? It's not just do not kill, it's the anger that you feel for your neighbor that you have killed them in your heart. It's not just do not commit adultery, but about how you lust about your neighbor. And N.T. Wright says, part of what makes this commandment so radical is that you can do nothing illegal by human standards and still be morally guilty before God. That's tough, right? This takes it beyond what we've seen in the first nine commandments. And in our 2024 world, I think one of the biggest hindrances to keeping this command is social media. Not only does it steal our attention, it can amplify our envy. It shows us other people's lives, which can be wonderful for the people that we know, seeing their kids, their travels, the food that they are eating. But it also shows us the lives of people who are not in our real life community. It forces us to draw comparisons with them. And it can lead us down this road of covetous desire, of envy, and we have to be wise that we don't do that. In the Gospels, Jesus would talk about the commandments a fair amount. In Mark 12, a scribe comes up to Jesus and asks him, "Of all the commandments, which is the first of all?" And the question is, does he mean like literally first, or does he mean the most important? Depending upon your translation, it may translate it one way or the other. And as he so often does, Jesus' answer is pretty good. He begins by summarizing the first four commandments by means of the Shema, which comes from Deuteronomy 6. And he says, "Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God, the Lord is one. You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your soul and with all your mind and with all your strength." But then Jesus says, the second is this, love your neighbor as yourself. So in a few sentences, Jesus sums up the first and the second tables of the commandments, to love the Lord your God and to love your neighbor as yourself. And the point is that the purpose of the commandments is love. We do not keep the commandments for our own benefit or even for our own standing. We keep them as a way to love God and to love our neighbor. If we return to our diagram that we've talked about over the last year or so of more conservative versus more progressive forms of Christianity, or evangelical versus mainline, we see that the evangelical end of the spectrum, where they may struggle, is the truth that you cannot love God without also loving one's neighbor. It can't be separated. And for those on the mainline side, one cannot properly love one's neighbor unless that love is rooted in the love of God. And these ideas are perfectly encapsulated in Jesus Christ, that in Jesus we see what it is like to love God with all of our being, and we see in what Jesus did, in his ministry, in his passion, in his death, what it means to love your neighbor as yourself. So we see that the commandments are about what it means to order your life around God's ways because you are already in relationship with him. And so my question for you, several thousand years after Jesus and even longer from the Ten Commandments, is how will you choose to live your life? How will you order your life? If these commandments were set up as the way for the Israelites to order their lives, what do you order your life around? Because whether you know it or not, you already have a rule of life. We've talked about this idea before, but a rule of life is the way in which you order your life, the way in which you go about your day, the things that you prioritize, the things that you give your time to, shows where you place your values. You already have one of those. The question is whether it serves you and ultimately points you toward the kingdom. Pastor and author Pete Scazzaro says this. He says, "Nurturing a growing spirituality with depth in our present-day culture will require a thoughtful, conscious, and intentional plan for our spiritual lives." The earliest apprentices of Jesus came up with the idea of a rule of life, a schedule and set of practices that create space for us to be with Jesus, to become like Jesus, and to do as Jesus did, all while living in alignment with who God uniquely created you to be. And the truth is, if we don't create a plan for making our vision of following Jesus a reality, it's tough for it to happen. It's not one of those things that just happens. There is that famous quote, "If you fail to plan, you plan to fail." I'm not sure who said it first, Benjamin Franklin or Taylor Swift, but people are unsure, right? But it's true that we aren't just going to stumble our way into becoming like Jesus. We must have intentional decisions, practices, and commitments in order for it to happen. John Mark Comer talks about a rule of life in his book, Practicing the Way, and he says that it is essential to turning your vision of following Jesus into a reality, of coming up with a plan. And he identifies 9 practices that are helpful for following Jesus, ones that we've talked about here regularly, we've done groups on, we'll continue to do groups on, but they are Sabbath, solitude, prayer, fasting, scripture, community, generosity, service, and witness. And so the question is, how do you go about making a rule of life? If you want to make an intentional plan for how you are going to follow Jesus, well, the first thing to do is to start with where you are at now, not with where you want to be. Be honest about where you are at now, and the best thing is to pick a few of these practices and identify 1 or 2 daily, weekly, and monthly habits. Let's say we take the practice of prayer as an example. You might choose to read and pray a psalm every day, and then pray for others weekly and go on a prayer walk every month. But you don't also have to limit your rule to just these 9 practices or even overtly spiritual things. You might include other important things in your life, like exercise regularly or sleep 8 hours a night, put your phone away at 8 p.m., read a novel, tend the garden, have a weekly dinner with friends, engage in a hobby that brings you joy, golf weekly, who knows? Meet with a therapist, attend AA. What are the things that God has created you to uniquely both enjoy and to need to do to become more like him? John Mark and his team have even created a rule of life builder. Here's a quick screenshot of that is helpful for ideas and help you with coming up with a plan. It's online, and then you can print it out, but put a QR code on the screen, and I'm going to put it in the e-news recap tomorrow, but what it does is it takes these practices and gives you ideas of things that you can incorporate into the rhythms of your life. Because that's part of what we see in the Ten Commandments. Out of the relationship that God already had with his people, he gave them a rule of life to follow. A rule that would lead to loving God and loving their neighbors. A rule that could guide their lives into a full expression of living daily in devotion to the God who had already done so much for them. It wasn't about putting the Ten Commandments on display in public places, but about putting who God is and what he is like on display by the way that they lived their lives. Because of that pre-existing relationship they had, their lives could testify to that God. And we get to do the same today. We don't have to get worked up about the Ten Commandments being on display in public places, but we can get worked up about living out who God is and what it means to live in him. And so again, what are you going to do to order your life in such a way that leads to becoming more like Jesus and doing as he did? What are the steps you need to take or the plan you need to make for your spirituality? Not in a rigid or legalistic type of way, but as an opportunity to grow deeper into your awareness of who God created you to be and how God wants you to live out his kingdom purposes. So, Antioch family, may we know that we are redeemed by God and because of that choose to live differently and put God's love on display for the world to see the goodness of God. Amen.